All right, good evening, everyone. We had kind of reached a watershed moment in our history of Polish and Eastern European Jewry in particular. And that watershed moment was what in Halacha they call Gzerot Tach V'Tat, which is the decrees or bad decrees of the years Tach and Tat, which correspond to 1648 and 1649. That was the Khmelnytsky rebellion and the Cossack rebellion led by Khmelnytsky, which began in the Ukraine and ultimately affected Poland. We said there's a bit of a debate as to how many Jews died. It could be as many as 100,000, but more likely something in the 10 to 20,000, which on the one hand, I guess in the long scheme of things and considering how many Jews there were in Poland, it wasn't a lot, but considering how many Jews there were in the Ukraine, it was massive. And it was also kind of the major shift and transformation in the comfort level of Jews in the Polish area. But we also pointed out last week that this change and shift was happening beforehand. That's because there was a good deal of upheaval that was going on throughout the European area. Also, in the as you start heading farther west into Germany, into Hungary, into Czechoslovakia, and those areas, there was the 30 Years' World War, as it's called, which was going on in Moravia, Bulgaria, something like that. That was going on in that area that was also having a detrimental effect on the Jews in that area. So you have the weakening of all parties in that area of Europe that was ultimately having a negative effect upon the Jews there. And so here, you can't talk about anyone in this time period without talking about the weakening status of Jewry, right? In the 1400s, for the most part in the 1500s, there was a very strong Jewish community that was generally doing very well. And now, ultimately, that very strong Jewish community is weakening because of the crumbling society around them. And it begins in the early 1600s, and really, I think it peaks in 1648 and 1649. And Les Mandepalig, no one argues that it's never the same for the Jewish community after that. So we're going to do today Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, who you can see for most of his career was before Khmelnytsky, and also he began outside of where a Cossack rebellion would be significant. In Wallerstein, Germany, and ultimately in Prague, later on, he's not really affected by the riots and the uprisings amongst the Cossacks, but he is very much in the crosshairs of the 30 Years' War, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller was early on seen to be an Eloi, a genius. He lost his father at a very young age, and was raised by his grandfather, Rabbi Moshe Wallerstein, who was a major Talmud Chacham of the time. And also, under his grandfather, he was pushed to go learn under the Maharal of Prague. Why is it important that he learned under the Maharal of Prague? Because this is going to be one of the defining factors of his career as a Jewish leader in general. Why is that? Because the Maharal had some very particular opinions about things. Number one is the Maharal was quite worldly. Even though he was generally discouraging of people being involved in secular studies, the Maharal himself was worldly. You can see that in his commentaries. In his commentaries, he shows a comprehension of philosophy. He shows a comprehension of science and mathematics. And all of those are going to be very much in the mind of Yom Tov Lipman Heller. Number two is the Maharal was very opinionated as to the educational system of the Jewish world. If you remember, the Maharal had this opinion that based on the Mishnah, that Jews should have a very particular and broad-based education, and we shouldn't focus on Talmud until the child is almost 15 years old. From 5 to 10, there should be a study only of Tanakh, certainly not according to the Parsha, because the Maharal felt that if you study only the Parsha, you were ultimately going to focus only on the first two or three Aliyos, and you weren't going to study the Parsha in its entirety. Instead, you should learn Tanakh Keseder, in order from the beginning to the end, from the ages of 5 to 10, that's all a child should see. From the age of 10 to 15, the child should focus only on learning Mishnah. And after 15 years old, you introduce the child to the Gemara and ultimately broader understandings and interpretations. That was the Maharal's feeling in general, and he was very much a proponent of that, and he felt like he could drastically transform Ashkenazi education if people would only follow him. And because of Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller's reputation that he gained as a genius very early on, he was given smicha at a very, very young age, and at 18 years old, he was appointed as a dayan, as a rabbinical court judge in Prague. And you're going to say, oh, big deal, rabbinical court judge, but no, the rabbinical courts did everything in those days. So he is basically a card-carrying Jewish leader in all senses of the word at the young age of 18 years old, in 1597. In 1624, he's made rabbi of Nikolsburg, Czechoslovakia. This is an extraordinarily important position, one which he holds for a few years. But the problem was the 30 Years' War. During the 30 Years' War, so the king, in order to finance this war, Ferdinand II, in order to finance this war, he placed a heavy tax upon all of his subjects, particularly the Jewish community. Why is this important? Because it was left up to the leadership, particularly the rabbis of the Jewish community, to levy these taxes. And what the Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller did was he instituted a graduated tax, and there was a feeling amongst some of the poorer people in the area that the rich were not upholding their fair share. So rather than voting Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller out of office, or which wasn't what they could do, or I don't know, you know, impeaching him, whatever it is, there wasn't much they can do. So instead, they informed on him to the authorities, Ferdinand II in particular, saying that he was writing anti-Christian and heretical things in his book, and he was given over to Ferdinand II. As a prisoner. So much so was the belief in his guilt amongst the Czechoslovakian authorities that he was sentenced to death. So the story goes that a wealthy gvir, a prince from far off, not Jewish, who was somehow helped, there are all these legends that go along with it, that he was somehow helped by Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller's family a long time ago, but he insisted on paying the fine and getting him out of the and having his death sentence commuted, and apparently his attempts were successful, and Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller was freed. He wasn't exactly freed, but basically they said, "Well, we'll change the punishment. Now, instead of killing you, you have to pay us an exorbitant sum of money. And number two is you are hereby exiled from Czechoslovakia." So, not exactly the best situation for him, but nonetheless, you know, anything, I guess, is better than death at this point. The Jewish community came together, raised the money, and here's the irony of the fact, is people were complaining about how they had to pay more money, and now, you know, you try to stop it and you end up paying more money. So they ultimately raised enough money to have Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller freed, and he was thereby exiled from Western Europe, and he had to head over to Eastern Europe, where he was accepted with a great deal of fanfare in Poland, in the very important communities in Poland. And there were communities, it seems, that were falling all over themselves to try to have him hired as their rabbi. And for a while, he goes around from community to community until finally, ultimately, he succeeds the Bach, Rav Yoel Sirkis, in Krakow. This is obviously an extraordinarily important position. So he started out in Lublin, then he goes to Ludmir, and ultimately he takes the position in Krakow in approximately 1635. It's unclear exactly when he does it, but he takes over for the Bach in this very high-profile position. Not only that, but when he comes to Poland, again, they were so excited about this great scholar coming to live among them, he becomes a permanent member of the Council Rabbinical Court of the Council of the Four Lands. This is the position to have, because, again, it's in terms of power, halachic and political, it's all in there, and it shows how much respect and honor they had for him as a Talmud Chacham and as an individual. And while he was there, one of his major contributions was a continued crusade against simony. If you remember when we discussed the Council of the Four Lands back a bunch of weeks ago, so we spoke about how one of the things the Council of the Four Lands was, they made a takana. One of their established rules was that rabbis could not purchase positions, nor could they be purchased for rabbis, positions of rabbinical authority. And there was real debate over this, because people felt, well, listen, if someone has a father-in-law who's got a lot of money and wants his son to be the rabbi and is willing to pay the salary, so, you know, let him do that. But the feeling among many of the leaders of the Council of the Four Lands, and I think we would all say rightfully, is that that will not necessarily grant you the most quality or qualified person for the job. So he was one of the crusaders against simony in the Council of the Four Lands, and quite successful in having that takana renewed. That was one of his great successes. He ends up being the leader of Krakow when you have this massive overturn with the Chmelnytsky pogroms in 1648 and 1649. And the last 5 years of his life is basically spent fundraising and trying to care for all of the refugees and the suffering orphans and families. He spent a good deal of time, we'll discuss in a little bit more detail, on the Aguna issues, because there were a number of Agunot that were left in the wake of these pogroms, because, you know, the Cossacks would say, well, we're coming, and they would give people, you know, a few hours to scatter, and people would scatter, and you would never find out, you know, what happened to this person, what happened to that person. And it created numerous situations of agunot because of that. And so he was one of the main people dealing with it. The legend goes, or what people say about him, is that he died basically penniless, because he gave away almost the entirety of his fortune and all of his money in service of taking care of people in the wakes of the pogroms of the Chmelnytsky raid. We know a good deal about his life because he wrote an autobiography. The title of his autobiography, I quote here, is Megillat Eva. Megillat Eva means the scroll of anger or of hatred. He gave the scroll this name, and it's hard to find, but he gave the scroll this name because he was so angry at Ferdinand II and the situation that forced him to leave Czechoslovakia. And that became basically the defining moment of his life, and he spends all of his time trying to care for Jews in the wake of that.
He wrote it in 1628.
What?
Wrote it in 1628.
He started writing it in 1628, but it contains a good deal of information for almost the majority of his life. So even his life in Poland is also described in Megillat Eva. So there's a lot of stuff there.
And the Chmelnytsky Massacre is in it?
Parts of it. You can imagine he was quite busy there, and I don't know if he was writing as much in there. There's no shortage of information on the Chmelnytsky massacres. One of the things that he did after the Chmelnytsky massacres, I was going to get to this, but I might as well do it now, is he wrote a number of keynotes about the Chmelnytsky massacres in great, great detail. there's a lot of debate amongst scholars over whether in the attempts to raise funds, people made the massacre sound worse. You know, oh, they left, you know, 65 orphans and 35 widows, and, you know, like, they might have made things sound worse because they needed to raise large sums of money to resettle thousands of people. So there's some feeling that things might have been made worse. And also, even if there wasn't a conscious attempt to do it, a lot of times when you're in the midst of it, you know, it's terrible. You know, for all of us, you know, you could get the flu, and then, you know, months later you're like, it wasn't that bad. But in the midst of the whole flu, you could be sitting there and saying, oh my gosh, I want to die. You know, you're hiding under the bed because you feel so terrible. So there is a little bit of that, but he's very involved in the recovery. And like I said, it basically dominated the end of his life. You know, he dies in 1654, still caring for all these people. You know, that it very much fell on his shoulders as the rabbi of one of the largest communities in Poland. All these, you know, trials and tribulations of his life did not prevent him from being uncommonly prolific. Probably what he's known most for is his commentary on the Mishnah. He wrote a Tosfos on the Mishnah called the Tosfos Yom Tov, which can be found in almost every edition of the Mishnah. You'll have Bar Tanura on one side, Rav Ovadia Bar Tanura, the great Italian scholar, and then on the other side you'll have Tosfos Yom Tov, which was somewhat lengthy, so in some of the smaller versions you'll have Ikar Tosfos Yom Tov, which takes his important questions. The way this book works is fairly similar to the way Tosfos works on the Gemara. It takes commentaries on the Mishnah, and it questions whether they're correct or not. He was a bit bold, and this, it seems like, one of the things that he got from the Maharal in terms of his interpretation of the Mishnah. Because, as we know, the Gemara was the first ones to interpret the Mishnah. And the Gemara often uses the Mishnah in a certain way, or comes to a conclusion where it has to reread a Mishnah in some way or another. Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller felt that one was within one's right to read the Mishnah without the Gemara and come to conclusions based on your own interpretation and own thinking, which is how sometimes he'll end up attacking Rav Ovadia Mibar Tanura. I brought it for you here, the quote here, the Tosfos Yom Tov in Nazir, Perikei. So he gives an explanation, and he defends this explanation as a great reading of the Mishnah, and he says, "Afal pisha b'gemara lo pirshu kein." He says, even though in the Talmud, this is not how they interpret the Mishnah, nevertheless, I think this is the proper proper interpretation. And he says, "Hol inya dina lo nafka mina v'lo midi." Since there's no really practical ramification as to whether I interpret it this way or that way. Harashut Natana Lafarish, she says, basically, it's within my ability to explain it however the heck I want, as long as I'm not paskening, there's no practical psak halacha issue that comes out of it. I am free to basically be the academic and interpret this Mishnah. She'ena ni roe hefresh bein ha-perusha Mishnah la-perusha mikra, sharashut Natana Lafarish b'mikro, kasher inyinu ra-ro'ot. He says, it's the same as interpreting Chumash. He says, no one has any qualms with the Ramban having a different interpretation of a Pasuk in Chumash than Rashi. You know, no one has any qualms with Ibn Ezra taking a different position. Or even if I were to write a Perush on Chumash, he says, and I were to give a different interpretation of a Pasuk, no one would have any problem with it because I am interpreting. I am, you know, I am embracing my exegetical right as a Talmud Chacham to interpret as I see fit. And since there's no practical halachic ramification to it, there's no problem with it. He says, Shemimota Gemara, El Shesariach, Shaloyach Rivar Sham Din Shie Soter Das Balea Gemara. He says, the only rule that I'm going to make for you is you can't come out to a conclusion that's different from the halacha and the Gemara. So you can, you know, be interpretive in the Mishnah, but realize that you're ultimately, we are bound by the conclusions of the Gemara in terms of halacha. That's what he says. This is extraordinarily bold. And also, it might be a underhanded criticism of the Shulchan Aruch, right? We all know that we've been discussing it a lot, that there was a hot debate over whether the Shulchan Aruch, as a code of Jewish law, should be the authoritative text or not. We spoke about, you know, those who rejected it, starting with the Maharshal, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, who was a contemporary and a cousin of the Ramah of Moshe Israelitz, who is one of the authors of the Shulchan Aruch, and was one of the most vocal critics of the whole endeavor in general. And included in these critics were the Bach, who is the immediate predecessor of the Tosfos Yom Tov in Krakow, and the Maharal, who was the teacher of the Tosfos Yom Tov. So the Tosfos Yom Tov seems to be saying, listen, we have a lot more freedom. The only binding statement that one would have here in all of halachic corpus is if the Gemara takes a halachic position. But unless the Gemara has taken a halachic position, I don't feel like that is binding to me in any way in terms of my responsibilities of interpretation. He seems to embolden himself in this type of position with other commentaries that he writes. He writes also a commentary on Rabbeinu Asher, right, who is one of the preservers of the halacha of the Balei HaTosfos and a posek in his own right, someone who doesn't always become the dominant opinion in the Shulchan Aruch, but he writes a commentary there where he's taking positions. So too, he writes a commentary on the Ramah's Toras Chatas. On the Ramah's very works, he writes a commentary as well, where he will argue as well on some of the Ramah's positions. That being said, his opposition to the Shulchan Aruch may not have lasted. There are some indications that he may have kind of softened his position as time went on and as he spent more time in Poland and in Eastern Europe. You know, in Western Europe, where the Ramah is a Polish guy, you know, who we don't know from. In Czechoslovakia, you know, the Ramah's the Ramah. So you go over to Eastern Europe and all of a sudden you get the Ramah spoken of in more legendary language and you see a community that has really committed itself to the words of the Shulchan Aruch. He might have softened his opinion on that. One of his biographers takes the position that he changed his mind actually on the Shulchan Aruch. And whereas originally he was kind of opposed to it, his position changed on that issue. So I wrote here, rejected the codification of the Shulchan Aruch forever, because it may be that he changed his mind on that position and was more accepting of the fact that it might be more authoritative than he realized. He was, we said, a proponent of a broadening Ashkenazic curriculum. He wanted to see more of the study of Mishnah, more of the study of Tanakh, in the schools, as well as also a study of philosophy and hashkafa and mathematics. And we'll get to that. So number one is he seems to have had, like many people in Eastern Europe in those days, a struggle with Kabbalah. Kabbalah was picking up steam and gaining popularity in Eastern Europe at that time. We've seen already some of the great Kabbalistic figures, some of them odder than others, but there was an undercurrent of Kabbalah in Eastern Europe as well. Why is it even more complicated when you think about it? Because there's Kabbalah as a philosophical endeavor, you know, as a way of approaching God. Do I approach God through the spherotic realm, through the Ari's Kabbalah, you know, through meditation and things like that, and, you know, symbolic interpretation of Chumash and all those other things that we've seen in past weeks. But then there was a secondary question, which is Kabbalah also takes halachic opinions, right? Kabbalah has more stringent halachic opinions on certain things. So let's just give an example. The classical Ashkenazic position is to wait 1 hour or less between meat and milk. However, the position within the Sephardic Jewry had always been 5 to 6 hours. Guess what position the Zohar takes? The Zohar seems to imply, or amongst the Kabbalists, it was clear indication that a longer period of time needed to be waited. So while in Germany and in Czechoslovakia and other places, they may be preserving the 1 hour the one-hour position, all of a sudden, in Ashkenaz, because Ashkenaz is Germany, in Eastern Europe, in Poland, in Ukraine, and in Lithuania, they are moving towards the more stringent position during this time of the 5 or the 6 hour wait time. And that's where it all comes from when, you know, our forefathers, the Balei HaTosfos, clearly say, well, all you got to do is rinse out your mouth and clean off the tablecloth and then have your ice cream. But no such luck. Those are the detriments of Minhag along with their positives. So the Tosfos Yom Tov, Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, does have a bit of a struggle with Kabbalah in general. And he points out in his Madne Yom Tov on Brachos, he says, in explaining the Talmud, he says, we have no dealing with esoteric matters. He was, in many senses, a Kabbalist. He has a working knowledge of Kabbalah. But in terms of comprehending the Gemara, interpreting the Gemara, and in terms of paskening halacha, he was not interested in using the Zohar or its interpretive methods in terms of understanding the Gemara. Which means he would understand a Bavli on its own without saying, and this is something the Vilna Gaon is going to struggle with later on when we get up to him, in terms of how much are we looking for parallels and complementarity between the Zohar and the Talmud itself. And those are kind of the issues which begin to weigh on the minds of halachists during this time where Kabbalah becomes important. It's important also to note this undercurrent of Kabbalah that's going on before 1648 and 1649, because this undercurrent is going to burst onto the scene with Shabtai Tzvi. Because Shabtai Tzvi is going to be coming out speaking of Kabbalah. And we already spoke about last week about how there was already this notion that the Zohar had predicted 1648 as a revolutionary year in Jewish history. And so you have all this working together to kind of, it's the perfect storm to create the very tension-inducing times that exist after 1648 and 1649 in terms of balancing the Jewish community and in terms of the direction it's going in. You know, the Shabtai Tzvi is going to lead into, you know, Chassidut is going to lead into Enlightenment, is going to lead into this, you know, constantly changing wave of the Jewish community in Eastern and Western Europe. And that's something we're going to have to keep our eye on. Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller was also a proponent of philosophy. So again, we pointed out how there was kind of a reemergence of the Maimonidean controversy in Eastern Europe during this time. The Rav Ma, Rav Moshe Isserles, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, was learning the Mor Nevuchim and discussing the philosophy of Aristotle, probably not in the original. He was probably learning Aristotle from the Rambam's Guide to the Perplexed, but nonetheless learning Aristotle. And the Maharshal, who was, in some ways more liberal on terms of Psak Halacha, on this issue felt that the Torah was wearing, you know, Sakva Efer, was wearing, you know, sackcloth and dirt because of it. And the position Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller takes is, it seems that he was learning philosophy. In a couple of places, he seems to be basing himself on Aristotelian philosophy, which he probably found in the Mor Nevuchim, in the Rambam's Guide to the Perplexed. I doubt anyone during this time was reading Aristotle, but, you know, anything's possible. But in either case, he clearly had a more open mind to the philosophical discussions. What he was clearly learning was Euclidean mathematics. That he was very much involved in geometry. We know that he was learning Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler, and he was involved in astronomy and in all of these things, because they come up when he is discussing various issues. In Kilayim here, I brought for you, this is how he decides the area of a vineyard in terms of deciding how to do Peya. You can see here, he has two radii, he has the square over the circle in terms of defining in Euclidean mathematics how to define the area of a circle. He's doing all of these things in terms of his discussion of the Talmud. And not only that, but he says in this section right here, he says, our mathematics is better now and there should be no shame. he says, in saying that, you know, we can understand this, you know, a little bit more directly or better now, and because we have this level of understanding and these new interpretations. So he's clearly doing that. I brought for you here just one of many places where he draws out these little diagrams in his commentary in order to illustrate the mathematical underpinnings of a various halachic sugya or something. We spoke about he was a great defender of Agunon, and that was just one of the many responsibilities he took on upon himself in the wake of the Cossack rebellion and in the wake of the many pogroms and the refugee problem that that had been created after that. And we said, you know, it's kind of a tragic death to him, is that he spends all of his time working on these various issues of Jewish community in the wake of the Cossack rebellions, of Tach V'Tat, that everyone said that he really did die penniless because of that. Actually, I sent out this email, and Tovia Brander actually pointed out to me that the great-great-grandchildren, the descendants of Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, still once a year have a gathering at a hotel on his yurt site, apparently, to celebrate the memory of their distinguished ancestor, Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller. So I don't know if anyone here is a distinguished descendant, but he certainly was a very, very important figure in those times, and it's good to know a little bit about him. He's kind of also a bridge between two communities. You have the Czechoslovakian community and the Prague community, and that area kind of being brought over into the Eastern European Polish community and kind of a cross-pollination. He's really one of the people who is very much involved in that. That is Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller in a nutshell.
What was his stance on Agunot?
I mean, there was no stance to have on Agunot. It was.
Did he try to free them?
I mean, that was the job of the Dayan. The Dayan's job is to free Agunot. Like that's what his job is. You know, that's going to be the job of Eastern European Dayanim forever, or Western European and Sephardic Dayanim. The job is to free Agunot. Actually, there's a bit of debate amongst halachists that Rabbi Bleich said that all those tshuvos regarding Agunot, he said there was no agenda. That was his claim, and that they were merely learning the halachic text, and wherever the halachic text would take them, that's the position they would take. And Mori Varabi, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, I believe his response at the Orthodox Forum was, I believe Rabbi Bleich and I must be reading different tshuvos. Because it seems to me like there was a clear agenda or an intent. Whatever it was, even if there's an agenda and intent, you know, it doesn't mean I'm not going to base myself well in the sources to allow it. But that's what they were more serious problems because there was no way to back anything up. You know, you couldn't do DNA testing. You couldn't do it. You were counting on witnesses, eyewitnesses, and many times eyewitnesses who didn't even know what they were looking for. Many times eyewitnesses who were highly untrustworthy or had other interests here. Because remember, there's inheritance issues that will go along with this also. You know, if there was a divorce paper involved, did he die before the divorce or after the divorce? You know, there are all these issues that could potentially be involved here. It wasn't simple things, and his position was, you know, I free as many women as I can. You know?
And the Maharal, you wouldn't call him a halachist? Another a Kabbalist?
So the Maharal doesn't quote Kabbalah, or rarely quotes Kabbalah.
But it's
an undercurrent. Right. But you'd be hard pressed to call him a Kabbalist. Was he a mystic? Yes. Was he a mystic? He was a mystic. Was he a Kabbalist?
So what's the difference between a mystic and a Kabbalist?
A mystic is someone who has a certain bent on the way he studies. A Kabbalist is referring to a specific, you know, type of methodology of interpretation of philosophy and of the Torah. Not every Kabbalist is a mystic, and not every mystic is a Kabbalist. And then the question is, where are you going to put Hasidim? Are they Kabbalists or not? It's hard to say. So there's a lot of Kabbalah in Hasidus, but, you know,
But didn't his mystic came from the Kabbalah?
Unclear. It might have come from the Maharal. You know, he might have been so creative that he came up with his own philosophy. He was an extraordinarily creative person. All right.